Advances in cyber technology, biotechnology, and robotics mean that more people than ever before have access to potentially dangerous technologies, from drones to computer networks and biological agents, which could be used to attack states and private citizens alike. Law and security experts Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Bloom look to these issues in the new book, The Future of Violence: Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting a New Age of Threat. Wittes and Bloom show that the time has come, they say, for governments to rethink their security efforts to protect lives and liberty. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Gabriella Bloom to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How did the two of you come to this particular subject and want to take on a subject matter that is rather large?
Ben was at the time working on issues of cyber and biosecurity. I was actually interested in drones. And the thing I was interested in was following the conversation, participating in the conversation about targeted killings by the government through the use of drones in Pakistan, Yemen, elsewhere. And it dawned on me that not that it wasn't a very important conversation to have, but that in some ways it was constricted. It assumed that drones were something that belonged in the military, that one could use against terrorists somewhere far away. But in fact, what's fascinating about drone technology is that it's available to you and me. We can go online, purchase one. We can build one today. Doesn't take fancy technology. Doesn't take fancy science. It's really available for everyone. And now we have to have a different conversation, not just about targeted killings of suspected terrorists, but what happens when everyone in society has access and can purchase or use these kinds of weapons, potential weapons, against one another. So then it became a very useful conversation to actually think about all these technologies together, the robots, the germs, the viruses, internet viruses, biological viruses, and see how all these technologies have very common features that make them especially interesting in the context of the future of our security.
As I mentioned, the subtitle, Confronting a New Age of Threat. In describing the drone, as you just did a moment ago, and the technology and the accessibility that we all have to it, at what point and how fine a line is this that that technology becomes a threat?
Technology, by and large, is a wonderful thing. It empowers us to do great, innovative, fantastic, benevolent things. It improves the quality of our lives, our life expectancy. There's no question about that. But the more available it becomes to a greater number of people, there is going to be a small minority, and small in a world of 7 billion people is still a significant one, that will look to use that technology for less benign purposes, whether it's actual acts of violence or just spying on people or hacking into their computers or stealing information or exploiting information. And at that point, it's a threat. Now, what makes these technologies different, why it's a new age of threat, is, you know, we know that it doesn't take fancy technology to inflict harm. But these technologies are not like nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, you can have a government monopoly. We actually do have government's monopoly over access to materials, access to the science, access to the actual infrastructure that is necessary to build them and use them. This is not true for these kinds of technologies that we all use and actually become so dependent on them that we are much more vulnerable to their abuse than we've ever been before.
How much do you think that this blindsided governments, world governments, global governments, as to the power and what could be done in disrupting the protection of the people?
So let's start from realizing that, you know, we tell a story where individuals and groups and corporations become very much empowered and that threatens the state. We should acknowledge immediately that the state, at least our state, is a very great beneficiary of technology. It's not that all these other actors are becoming stronger and our state is becoming weak and paralyzed. That's not the case. The state itself, at least the developed countries, become also empowered by technology, and we see it every day. But what needs to be recognized is that, first, not all countries around the world are the United States government. And even for the United States government, the task of now protecting each of us as citizens against a plethora of threats from both near and far away is becoming an almost insurmountable task. And then what you need is much greater cooperation among states, between states, to prevent the world from turning into the Wild West. So we actually predict that we're going to see much more of that cooperation because it's absolutely necessary. But I'm afraid that we're also going to see much more unilateralism, whether it's spying on foreign citizens, whether it's trying to extend our laws far beyond our borders, whether it's the most aggressive means of things that today we think about, again, targeted killings in the context of terrorism. But you could imagine a pressure on governments to engage in coercive activities against potential perceived threats far more than they are inclined to do so today.
You do get a sense in reading the book that while all is not lost, certainly, that we have come to the party a bit late.
So it depends for which purposes. We are currently constantly under certain types of attacks. So cyber attacks are an everyday occurrence, and by and large, we're able to live with them and tolerate them in the same way that we tolerate all kinds of domestic everyday crime at different orders of magnitude. In that sense, we're already late. We're also already late in terms of, and that we would always be late to trying to prevent the spread of technology. It's a futile exercise. We shouldn't even think about that. That's not where we should be focusing our efforts. We have been, whether fortunate or for other reasons, still haven't experienced the really catastrophic cases of attacks, whether through the use of cyber-dependent utilities or technologies, or whether, you know, spread of bio attacks. And for that, we really need to prepare. And we need to prepare by better defensive mechanisms, by greater, we think, regulation, by harnessing much more the private sector, not just in terms of when the private sector voluntarily chooses to participate, but expecting certain things from the private sector in terms of what it owes us in terms of our personal and national security.
You do write in the book that in our new world, not only do privacy and security not generally conflict, but they are often largely the same thing. How so?
If you think about airport security, so there's a lot of conversation right now around surveillance, and there is a sensibility that the Big Brother is spying on us, and it's a terrible thing, and it's done in the name of some amorphous interest in security, but a real harm to our privacy and liberty. Now, if you think about airport security, airport screening, we don't call it surveillance because we're uncomfortable with calling it surveillance, but it is surveillance. We just call it screening. And you could see immediately how going through those lines of security TSA screening is uncomfortable, but we do it both because it improves our security and because it improves our liberty. It allows us to use air travel in a way that we otherwise wouldn't be comfortable to do. And so there isn't really necessarily a conflict between these interests. More often than not, they're going to be mutually reinforcing in the sense that what protects our privacy or information also protects our security. So if you think about your medical records or your bank statements, you want those secure both because they are your privacy and because intrusion into this data could badly affect your security. So there are many ways, there are more ways in which all these interests are going to be compatible and demand a type of measure rather than thinking about them as we're giving one to gain more of the other.
And you make this point, and it's rather mind-boggling to think about, but if we think of the state's responsibility and ultimately a purpose to provide security to its citizens, that state power represents this critical line of defense for individual freedom and privacy, even as the state may be losing the ability to serve that purpose.
That's right. And this is where the private sector really comes in. So, again, the government itself cannot protect you from any and all harms, even those that we traditionally have thought about as national security. So, actually, a good analogy to think about is food and drug safety. The government doesn't make sure that the food you eat or the drugs you take are safe. The government has no capacity to ensure that. What the government does is it orders the companies that produce that food or drugs to make sure that they are safe for consumption. And I think the same thing is going to have to happen in the security sphere as well. So the corporations that use your data, that store it, that provide internet-based services for you, companies that deal with biological materials, that sell gene sequencing or laboratory equipment, that manufacture robots for all kinds of purposes, they now must owe us, the citizens, some security responsibilities, some responsibilities for due care and due diligence, that because they are necessary, they're essential for our defense.
As you point out in the book, while we seem to be in a whole new world and all of this technology is coming in, that you point to the founding fathers and to even Hobbes is figuring out that this has long been on the radar. Like, we've been dealing with a number of these issues for a very long time.
So in some ways, there isn't a lot that is new in the sense that there have always been security threats. They've been territorial, they've been extraterritorial, and as you rightly know, the whole Hobbesian justification for the nation state, whether it's Hobbes or Locke or any of the Enlightenment theorists, was to protect us from the state of nature. So the deal was we as citizens come together and we agree to surrender our right or liberty to use force to protect ourselves, and we give it to the Leviathan, the government, in exchange for protecting us from one another and from both internal and external threats. Now, the question is the government less able than before to provide those defense functions? And we argue that yes, that even though everything is sort of a spectrum, nothing is brand new, at some point the quantitative difference becomes one of a qualitative degree. So just think about the idea of territorial versus extraterritorial. We tell in the book the story of Luis Mijangos, who was an individual in Orange County, California, who wrote his own software code that infiltrated into the webcams of young women and girls, took surreptitiously pictures of them in general various stages of undress, and then used those pictures to what the FBI called sextort his victims into providing sex videos for him. And he was caught by the FBI. The FBI estimated that he must have harmed an upward of 200 young women and girls, and that many more victims remain unaccounted for, many of them, by the way, underage. And so the only silver lining in the story is that Luis Mijangos happened to be in Northern California, now where the FBI has jurisdiction. Now, what happens when Mijangos is in Nigeria or the Ukraine or any number of other countries where a lot of your spam emails comes from? And once you understand that that is the new model of defense, this is the new challenge of defense, you understand how much more complicated the Leviathan's functions or responsibilities are now as compared to past times.
That's an interesting term of just using the word Leviathan.
That's Hobbes' term.
Yes, right.
Yes.
I mean, that says a lot just in its usage, doesn't it?
Yes, there is a way in which you could think about and there are people out there who say, you know, the end result of all of this is just chaos and anarchy. There is no way that you could engage in any meaningful governance. We don't go there. We don't believe it's the end of the state. We think the Leviathan, the state, still has very important functions to play, and we have to rely on it. It actually is essential for our security going forward. What does need to happen is sort of the rethinking of what is the model of good governance, both domestic and international, that actually provides these defensive responsibilities in an effective manner and without giving up our sort of essential commitments to privacy, liberty, democracy, and all those other values that we cherish and think that the state must abide by.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting a New Age of Threat. The book is written by Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Bloom. Gabriella is the Rita Hauser Professor of Human Rights and International Humanitarian Law at Harvard Law School. Gabriella, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Future of Violence. It is published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.